KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today. Today I'm excited to have on a colleague who is not too far from Stanford campus, Professor Eric Goldman of Santa Clara University School of Law. Eric is a, like me, is someone who's new to the Academy, although not quite as new as me. Eric's been at this for a few years, and has written some very interesting work ranging from trademark law to marketing regulation. And Eric is writing in a variety of areas, many of which are not topics that we've discussed very much on Hearsay Culture. So I'm very excited to have Eric on today to kind of have a wide-ranging discussion of issues ranging from domain name registration and regulation, based upon a talk that he did at a conference involving ICANN at McGeorge University Pacific School of Law a few weeks ago that I attended, to issues involving trademark law, which is another area that generally in the technological field people don't necessarily think of immediately as being relevant. And we're going to discuss some of the interesting issues revolving around trademark law, one of the three or four major areas of intellectual property, as well as taking a look at a paper that Eric wrote focusing particularly on marketing regulation in the technological world. So it's going to be a pretty wide-ranging discussion, one of those discussions that I've had periodically on the show, which could go in any number of directions. But I'm going to try to touch on a number of the areas that Eric focuses on in his both his scholarship as well as his blogs, which we'll talk about as well. By way of very brief background, Eric joined the Santa Clara University School of Law faculty in 2006, both as an assistant professor and director of the school's high-tech law institute. He was previously an assistant professor at Marquette University School of Law, as well as general counsel of epinions.com, and also he practiced law at Cooley Godward. He teaches cyber law and intellectual property, teaches copyright, contracts, software licensing, and professional responsibility, and he is also the author of several blogs, which I'll let him discuss, but the main one that I read often is his tech and marketing law blog, which is a kind of a compendium of information relating to those two areas, and you also get the benefit of Eric's often slightly different and slightly skewed views of cases and controversies occurring in technology, ranging from search engine regulation to the recent RescueCom case, which Eric blogged about recently. So I'm very excited to have Eric on. He's actually come here from Santa Clara, so we'll be doing the show in studio. It is being recorded on March 6th, but it will be aired obviously a week or two later. So when we return from a short music break, we will be joined by Professor Eric Goldman of Santa Clara University School of Law here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM. And if I have done my job properly as I fade out the more unusual music that I've played on the show, and we are joined on the other side of the glass by Eric Goldman. Eric, I see you, and hopefully we can hear you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. As you said, we're at the on campus in the bowels of Memorial Auditorium. But after that music, I feel like I just walked in from the Australian Outback.
Yeah, well, you know, those didgeridoos are always a fascinating addition to any piece of music, much less jazz. And were this a music show, the next 6 minutes would kind of change course. But I thought it was an appropriate way to bring you onto the air with some mysterious music. So thank you very much for being here today, Eric.
Well, thank you for having me.
And let's jump right in. I've asked this question, actually, before we get into some of the substantive topics. I'm going to blindside you with a relatively personal question, which boils down to this. I'm always curious to ask people how they got to the point where they are today. So I'm curious, how did you get interested in intellectual property and in technology and marketing issues and trademark and what have you? What brings you to this point?
Okay. So actually, I had an epiphany, and this was in December of 1992, and I remember it well. I was on the UCLA Law Review, and I was required to write a paper for that. And I was casting around for paper topics, trying to figure out what to write about. And I got turned on to email. I got my first email account in 1991. And so I decided to write on the topic of when a web host, or in that case, a bulletin board operator, was liable for the actions of its users. And I was writing this paper December of 1992 during winter break. And I was obsessing about it. And I realized that I had to make a choice. Either I was going to put the paper aside and go enjoy the winter break like any normal student, or I was going to embrace it and realize I'd found something important to me. And I chose the latter. I realized that that's what I wanted to do with my life, and I decided I wanted to become an internet lawyer. So at the time, there really wasn't a market for that, but I got hooked up with a law firm here in Palo Alto, and through the course of that, I was able to build my practice slowly as the internet boom took over.
So you were able to actually get in fairly early into the internet world itself.
Well, people have been doing computer law since the 70s even.
Right.
And that generation of computer lawyers will insist that there are no new issues, that all the issues were wrestled with then.
Right.
So in that respect, I'm not early, but I definitely caught the first wave of the internet boom.
The internet part, yeah.
And it has been a great ride. It certainly was a terrific ride in the 1990s.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's funny because now being a technology lawyer isn't quite as unique. At the same time, as you mentioned, the issues that we're dealing with are mutating a little bit so that some of the answers in the past that we've gotten do apply and others don't, which perhaps is a nice segue into talking about some of the substantive issues today. Let's start off with ICANN. Now, ICANN, I'll let you explain in more detail, but for listeners who aren't familiar, ICANN is the entity that regulates domain names and is the entity really that in many ways has been the focus of a lot of disputes in the past. Derek and I had the benefit of going to a conference at University of Pacific a few weeks ago focusing on the issue of ICANN regulation. Let's start off, Eric, just for listeners who aren't too familiar. Could you give a basic definition of what ICANN is? I think I'm going to assume that listeners know what a domain name is, so we'll skip that. But the ultimate question we'll jump into and get into what your presentation was. What is ICANN, and is it, in fact, still an important entity?
So we have a system for communicating with each other over the internet, and that system requires each person communicating with another to have a unique IP address. This is just like having a unique phone number or a unique mailing address. We have a unique addressing system for internet communications. And that system is all built on a series of numbers. Those numbers are not the most intuitive to remember. So we've overlaid on top of that the mnemonic addressing system of domain names. These are short and easy ways to remember the IP addresses associated with particular destinations. And there has been a long-standing tussle over who could control the allocation of domain names. On the one hand, we could let free market reign, we could let standards develop, and the best standard would win in the marketplace, but for a while, at least, we would have anarchy. So instead, there's been a coordinated system for allocating the IP addresses to make sure that everyone has some unique way of messaging with another party on the internet. So ICANN was developed in the late 1990s as a nonprofit, non-governmental organization designed to manage the process by which domain names would get allocated. And that includes at least two separate issues, one with respect to existing domain name systems, who would get which domain names in that system, and then separately, should there be new domain names or new top-level domain names. And so they also are involved in doing that. I guess there's a third piece, which is that they could also retire top-level domains, which they've actually recently done.
Right.
So ICANN is the administrative body that governs the allocation of domain names.
The ICANN itself, going back to the prehistoric ages prior to the year 2000, there was a lot of talk of ICANN arbitrations and being an ICANN arbitrator and all that kind of stuff. And you don't hear a lot about ICANN anymore. And I'm curious to get your thoughts. I know we discussed this at the conference, but where is ICANN today in terms of its relevance vis-a-vis entities like Google and search engines and what have you, in your opinion?
Well, I break that issue apart. There's the overall question about the role of domain names as a navigational system in the information ecosystem. And there's a bunch of different ways people can navigate. Let's come back to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. Within the domain name system, ICANN is extremely relevant. And there are people making millions of dollars today in the domain name system. So there's a lot of economic power that's directed towards ICANN to govern its behavior. The decisions that ICANN makes can create wealth for people or, in theory, take it away. So there is an entire industry focusing on ICANN, but it's relatively obscure in the sense that most of the everyday users of the Internet won't encounter it. But maybe we should talk a little about the navigational issue, because that's really, I think, the more interesting question.
Right.
There are these millions of dollars that are being won and lost in the domain name system. And for the problem I have is I don't understand why, because I'm not sure exactly what role domain names play as a navigational tool to help people get from point A to point B on the Internet. Back in the day, back in the 1990s, there was a lot of value in domain names for two reasons. One, there was the theory that people were guessing domain names, that they would literally say, I'm interested in topic X, and they would put in x.com into their web browser and see what they got. Mm-hmm. Nobody does that anymore today because you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a lot of pop-ups and porn. So the other reason why they had value is that a lot of websites were building their corporate identities off of their domain name. So, you know, classic example is something like pets.com. And pets.com is a lousy trademark, but as a mnemonic that people could remember, it's a terrific way to say, if you're interested in pets, we are going to have something relevant to you. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were investing in domain names back at the time, but the reality is that nowadays there's a lot of reasons not to use domain names. As I said, people are lousy typists, and they can end up typing the wrong domain name, end up in places that they don't want, and people don't always remember what domain name. Now with the proliferation of top-level domains, it's become more confusing to remember where a particular website is. So the social science has suggested that people are making the search engines either going to a Google.com or using a toolbar like the Google toolbar as their primary way of navigating from point A to point Z. Instead of typing in a domain name into the web browser, they type it into the search box and search for that particular domain. And the consequence of that is, it makes me wonder, why do domain names matter if search engines have usurped their principal navigational functions?
It's an interesting question, and it's one that kind of begs the larger question, which I want to pose to you, which is, what are people ultimately looking for when they go onto the Internet? When, like you said, and I think it's true, if, you know, in the pre-Google days where search engines were one way to access, to really get information, and they weren't comprehensive, and you didn't really know much you were gonna get, people would randomly type a name in and hope that they hit it, and you'd have to type the http://. I'm not sure how many Internet users even realize that they have to do that anymore. And indeed, the www dot prefix is also largely a dinosaur. I'm curious because it does open up this question. Do you think that Internet users today are looking for the same kind of information that they did, say, 7 or 8 years ago? It's not a question I'm expecting any empirical data on, but I'm curious to get your sense of it as you've thought about these things. Is it, in fact, a consideration in your analysis?
Well, think about the domain name system as a type of search engine. Mm-hmm. You put in a keyword, pets.com or stanford.edu, and you get a search result. You get the actual web page that's associated with that domain name. And the problem with the domain name system as a navigational tool, putting aside the typographical error problem, is that you only get one search result. Mm-hmm. So instead of seeing a list of options, you get one. And if it's not the right one, then you got to figure out where to go next. And that's one of the reasons why search engines have, I think, become so popular, is because you're given a buffet of choices.
Right.
And even if you and I aren't looking for the same thing, but we choose the same keywords, we might still be able to make very quick and efficient matches through a search engine interface. So when you ask what people are looking for, my point is the one search result per keyword, which is the basic architecture of the domain name system as a navigational tool, actually forces people to pick the same objective in order to get the right results. Mm-hmm. Whereas search engines allow a heterogeneous interest to end up getting their needs met even if they pick the same keyword.
The presentation you did at McGeorge and the flipping that you hear in the background is as I turn to your slides. I know your slides are available on your webpage, and we'll get to that in a moment. But let me kind of state your general thesis and kind of see, you know, where it takes us. So you titled your talk, Keyword Regulation and Domain Name Exceptionalism. And you pointed out an interesting comparison, which is the relatively large number of laws that focus on domain name issues and regulation, and the relatively few, if any, laws that focus on keywords. And yet keywords, as you pointed out, and I think internet users, given some thought, would see, are far more important today in terms of accessing content. So with regard to your thesis, it seems, and maybe I'll just say what is your thesis, and then the follow-up question from there would be the ultimate question, which is, why is it that we have more law in the range of domain names and less in keywords, putting aside the simple issue of domain names are simply people, things that people are more familiar with and have been around longer as a means, as you put it, to get information off the internet?
Well, my thesis is that the distinction in regulation between domain names and keywords doesn't make any sense, that they are the same thing to users, and therefore we should treat them equally from a regulatory standpoint. And this is not atypical in cyber law generally, that we have these anomalous regulatory developments where a new technology emerges and there can be this very emotional response to it. Wow, this is new, special, and different. We need to think about treating things differently. And in some respects, domain names have the vestige of that. When domain names came around, they were viewed as unique, special, and different. And so we saw this plethora of laws adopted to treat them as such. Now, as you pointed out, back in the 90s, there wasn't a whole lot of really robust search engine tools available. And so domain names had some role to play in the navigational, as part of the navigational tool set of a user. And so what happened is that the laws developed to try to treat domain names, to preserve the validity or the integrity of the domain name system as a navigational tool in order to reinforce the expectation that someone would put in the keyword into the address bar and get, quote, the right result. So so the regulatory structure was designed to prop up this one result per keyword approach. Again, in an environment where search engines have usurped that value, that model just doesn't make any sense.
The model itself is premised, I think, partially, as you pointed out, in the fact that search engines really weren't as robust and didn't have as much value as they do today. It leads me to the question that I actually asked you at the conference, and I think is an interesting one, which is the question of what we do. And you pointed out in your presentation really a couple of options with regard to domain names themselves, and they're either, two possible regulatory options you pointed out are to regulate search keywords like domain names or to deregulate domain names entirely. And the locus of the question boils down to, and I kind of want to focus on the second response, which is deregulation. If we take domain names out of the realm of regulation, if we take domain names and treat them as we do keywords today, are we putting more power into the search engines such that we then have if there is a problem, the locus of the problem has shifted from the world of domain names and ICANN to the Googles and the Yahoos and the MSNs?
Well, there's no question that the movement away from domain names as a navigational tool to search engines as a navigational tool has put significant power into the hands of search engines as arbiters of relevancy and perhaps even as arbiters of taste. But let's go back to the architecture of the domain name system as a navigational tool. There was a relevancy algorithm of sorts built into that model, which is whoever got the domain name first got to keep it unless there was some way of disturbing that allocation. So That model as a way of allocating keywords where only one content provider can be associated with them is actually rather poor as a relevancy algorithm. Mm-hmm. So all these regulatory efforts to try and prop up that system are ultimately doomed for failure. But recognize there was an arbiter of relevancy. There was an intermediary deciding the mechanism of how that match would be made. It was the domain name registration system, which was principally first come, first serve. Mm-hmm. So now when we move to search engines, we have a new method of allocating the keywords and the matches that are made with them. And there's no question that search engines can have their own agenda in allocating those keywords that might not track users' expectations. Mm-hmm. At that point, then we simply have to ask, will market forces conform their behavior in order to keep them providing constantly updated and relevant results? Or will consumers say, this isn't working and I'm going to go somewhere else if there's another option?
The our friend Frank Pasquale over at Seton Hall, and I don't think I could have a search engine conversation without mentioning Frank. Frank was on the show a few months ago, and as you know, he's written extensively this area, and he's working on a project right now where, to put it in a nutshell, he's suggesting the possibility that the Federal Trade Commission should actually regulate search engines. Now, he's kicked around the different ideas, and when he was on the show, we kind of kicked around some of the pros and cons. But knee-jerk reaction, should the FTC be in have under its jurisdiction the regulation of search engines?
Well, I think they do. So let's be clear. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of things that search engines could do or, in fact, may have done that would be squarely within FTC control.
Right.
But in terms of
as a should question.
In terms of the allocation of search results, the decision about which results are, quote, the right ones and which ones are the wrong ones, we can have two principal mechanisms to decide that. Mechanism number one is that consumers can manifest their votes by choosing which search engines actually meet their needs. Or we can have the government come in and say, here's the right result and the wrong result. And it's been my working theory that as between those two choices, it's far more likely that the invisible hand of the market will lead to better search results than command and control dictation of search results by fiat.
The another interesting issue that Frank and I discussed, and I'm kind of doing shotgun questions here, but I'm curious to get your unvarnished thoughts. And you did mention before we went on the air that you might want to turn the tables, and so I'm welcoming you to do that if you'd like. Feel free to shoot me with random questions. But in connection with another part of the conversation we had with Frank was the issue of Google bombing, which I know is one you're familiar with. And I posed the question to Frank, and I thought about it more. Which is ultimately, what's so bad about it? I mean, and I guess I'm asking that question of you. I mean, if people are going to game search engines so they can somehow configure it and play, and you, it's pretty much, you know, common knowledge that there are ways to do these things, and in fact, there are companies and consultants that brag about their ability to, if you give me the opportunity, I will be able to put your content within a day or two and on the front page of Google. What's wrong with that? If the public knows, and that's the big F for me. If the public knows that there is a certain algorithm that exists, there's a certain way that you can actually game a search engine to get your content up front, why is that bad?
I'm not even sure I would start with the question, if the public knows. We could take that out, and I don't think my answer would change. Mm-hmm. But do you mind, can I just explain Google bombing
please,
for this
yeah,
audience?
No, yeah,
just
to make sure. For the benefit of those, yeah, absolutely.
Because it makes a difference when I explain it. So Google bombing is an interesting phenomenon. Search engines often now will index not only the content of a web page, but they will index the content of people who link to that page and the words that are used to establish the link. So, for example, if you at hearsayculture.com point a link to my website, ericgoldman.org, and you use in that the word pig, it may be that the search engines will say, Dave Levine thinks that the word pig is related to Eric Goldman's website. So not only are we going to capture all the information on Eric Goldman's website, we're going to capture the word pig and assume that it's relevant to his website as well. And that's a choice that search engines make to try and think about what content will ultimately lead to the right result for a particular user. We call the language that you would use to establish a link to my website the anchor text. So search engines index the words that are contained in links to a website along with the content on that website. And what's happened just in the last few weeks since you interviewed Frank mm-hmm. is that Google made a very prominent announcement that it was de-emphasizing the amount of credit that it gave to anchor text in its relevancy algorithms. So what that's meant in practice is that it's actually become much harder to do what you would call Google bombing because they're giving less credit to the links, the information that's contained in those links. Mm-hmm. So I think that's actually a nice reinforcement of the point that I've made, which is the idea is that Google bombing could lead to the wrong result. If all the people on the web pointed links to George Bush's website, and in those links they said the words miserable failure. So when you mm-hmm. search for the word miserable failure, you got George Bush's website as the first result. If Google thinks that that's the wrong result, they might jigger with the algorithm, which is exactly what they did, and that's no longer the top result. If you search for the word miserable failure, it's changed. So the search engines have listened to the marketplace in a sense. They've determined that maybe they were giving too much credit to anchor text, and they've dialed their algorithms accordingly. This is why I'm such a fan of the market as opposed to, say, the FTC or other regulatory bodies. Mm-hmm. We could have had the FTC saying, you can only give X percent to anchor text in your relevancy algorithm. But the market's going to figure that out itself, and they're going to do a whole lot faster, and I assert a whole lot smarter than any government body could.
It is the marketing aspect is a nice cliffhanger for a short music break, because when we return with Professor Eric Goldman of Santa Clara University School of Law, I do want to get into issues involving marketing, both from the trademark perspective and from a technology perspective generally. You're listening to KZSU's Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. We're going to take a short music break, and when we return, we'll continue the conversation with Eric Goldman. Some would consider it a crime to actually interrupt Thelonious Monk with a plea for money, but that's what I do on this show, so here I am again. So before we return with Eric Goldman, I do want to ask you now what I do every time on the show, which is I get out my small cup and I ask you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford University, and it relies on the generosity of listeners to continue its sports, music, entertainment, public affairs, Hearsay Culture, you name it, programming. Hopefully you enjoy some, perhaps all, of the programming here on KZSU, but if you're listening at all, I encourage you to consider donating to KZSU, and if you'd like to, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, please continue to listen. So we're back with Eric Goldman. And Eric, let's jump right into the marketing cliffhanger that you mentioned before. You wrote an interesting article, which a few years ago, involving an analysis of marketing, and the title of the article, which I am grabbing right here as I flip through these papers, that sadly somehow got stained with, I think, coffee, but I don't drink coffee, so I'm not sure how this happened. But it's called A Kozian Analysis of Marketing. So maybe what was your thesis of that piece, which is very current, and how does it fit into the kind of areas that you seek to focus on in your scholarship?
So that piece came from the classic discussion that comes up over and over again when it comes to marketing, that in some way marketers impose costs on consumers. And I really want to try and figure out what those costs were and then figure out what regulatory proposition we ought to have to allocate those costs. I explained in the paper about why focusing on the cost offload to marketing actually doesn't really do the right job of cost accounting, that we undercount some of the benefits and maybe overstate some of the costs. And then I talk a little bit about how we can use that insight to develop a regulatory structure for marketing. And I point to the main problem that we have with marketing, that there are people who want to buy stuff and there are people who want to sell stuff, but there's a matching problem between them. And the really difficult part of making the match is that consumers have all of these interests and preferences that are not well known, but it's costly for them to explain those interests. It takes time in their part, and it might also expose them to privacy issues. So the end of the paper discusses how technology is actually going to bridge that gap by capturing on an automated basis consumer preferences and helping consumers manage the inflow of marketing content to them. And in that way, we'll actually reduce the cost that marketers impose on consumers, assuming that's even the right vernacular, mm-hmm. but we'll also make better matches in the marketplace.
The one of the concerns that you mentioned in the article, and it's one that's quite timely, is spyware and adware, which is always a challenge and an annoyance for those people that are familiar with spyware and adware. It's particularly annoying, but it's even more pernicious for those that are unaware that it's surreptitiously being installed in your computer. Now, obviously, you're not suggesting that spyware and adware are good things.
I'm not sure I quite said that.
Yeah,
Let's explore that a little more.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I want to go. So what I do want to ask you about really is in your article you discuss the practical side effects of the anti-spyware and anti-adware regulations that exist. What are some of those side effects that consumers may not be aware of and that policymakers may not be considering when they pass these otherwise well-intentioned laws?
Well, so I describe my paper in shorthand as a defense of spam and spyware, mm-hmm. Just to stir the pot a little bit.
Right. And it makes for good radio.
Well, if we were live, I'm sure the phones would be lighting up instantly. There's no defense of spam, and there's no defense of spyware.
The benefit of recording.
If you don't feel that, if you vehemently disagree, I strongly encourage you, read the paper. Let me make my case to you. It took 70-some-odd pages to do so, so it's a complicated defense. But with respect to adware and spyware, the idea is that consumers have all of this great information about what they want out of life. And that needs to be captured in automated fashion, or else consumers have to recreate that on demand for a particular individual. So you can tell Amazon what you're looking for, and that takes time. And some people will customize the tools that they have with Amazon, but very few people actually do so in a way that improves the results that they get through it. Or you could have a tool that's automatically capturing that so that you don't have to change your behavior, but still there's going to be people who will gain the insights of what you really care about by your behavior. Mm-hmm. And so that automated capturing of consumer behavior looks a lot like spyware, or looks a lot like adware. It's the monitoring of behavior in the background in order to lead to the delivery of content that's putatively tailored to your interests. And so regulators have been trying to take that technology out of consumers' hands, even if they want it. There were two laws passed in Alaska and Utah that specifically stripped out of consumers' hands the ability to use software that would capture their behavior automatically and generate putatively relevant results for them, even if the consumer expressly asked for it. And that's what I really targeted as my bogey when legislators are taking power out of consumer hands to help them find what they're looking for.
The challenge that you identify is one that's interesting, because you're definitely taking a position that is controversial, which makes it fun. It'd be certainly more boring if you said, yeah, that's bad and we can move on from it. So I do want to challenge you on that point a little bit, which is really, you know, a kind of a broad level question, which is content regulation generally, and then specifically, do we want software that markets to us? If we're on the internet, let's put aside, actually, let me give you two quick hypotheticals. So first, the traditional internet shopper, this person who's going on the internet because they're looking to buy a book, and they're going to look at Amazon and they're going to find the best price. And then take the person who's doing, you know, the high school student who's doing a paper on the history of South Dakota and gets a pop-up saying, come visit South Dakota from the South Dakota Chamber of Commerce. And I'm making up these hypotheticals. But the question becomes, in those two scenarios, do we want software that's going to market to us regardless of our consent?
Well, I didn't say without our consent.
No, I'm asking hypothetical.
I think we have to distinguish that a little bit.
Yeah.
What I'm really focusing on is regulation of technology. That's right. Not a new theme, I'm guessing, for this show, and
right.
It's definitely not a new theme.
Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest that that's what you said in your article.
Cyber law.
Right.
But I'm going to challenge you in turn a little bit. Let's go back to your statement. Do we want software that's marketing to consumers?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, why wouldn't we? And maybe I could state it slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
We use software as a crutch or as an aid to help us do things that would otherwise be too time consuming or too difficult for us to do. And I don't care if content is marketing or editorial content. In my mind, they're the same things. Either they're helpful to consumers or they're not. And if it's marketing or editorial content, it's all good in my book. And we do want software, I think, that will help us manage the inflow of data that's coming across our attention sphere. And software is the way for us to cope in an environment of information overload. And it's going to be managing all the content coming in, whether it's marketing or editorial content. I don't really care about the difference. In the end, the result is the same. If the software thinks that marketing would be relevant to a consumer and the consumer thinks that that's a helpful way for them to manage their data flows, they should have that choice. Mm-hmm. Taking that away from them, I think, is a harm to everyone.
So I will attempt to answer your question in turn. And yeah, I should make it clear. You know, I forgot to do this because I do say it. I certainly, in this case, would certainly commend anyone to take a look at the article, and we'll get the links at the end. I would not purport to be capable of summarizing a 70-page article on the fly on the radio show, but I will challenge this point and respond to you in turn. It seems to me that when we're interfacing with the internet, we obviously are exposing ourselves to the vagaries of life. You know, it's the traditional analysis that the Supreme Court put down that when you set foot outside your door, we cannot regulate the behavior of everyone and you have to subject yourself to those risks. I can analogize that to the internet. But to me, it seems to me that when we're dealing with something that is potentially intrusive, like marketing, there's a different set of analyses. And I guess, I didn't mean to suggest that your paper was saying that spam, that basically adware and spyware and what have you could just run surreptitiously and that's fine. But I do think that if we start getting closer to the line in terms of thinking about what it is that this software is doing, that we do have a serious question that we need to address, and it would be the answer to the question of do we want this to happen at all. My answer ultimately would be no. Now, maybe the reason that I'm going to give you is intrinsic to the kind of software that's out there today, but I want to get your response to it. There's a lot of analysis being done of what exactly these programs are doing. And in many cases, the programs are doing things that they do not identify in their disclosures to the extent that they exist. And oftentimes, the information that's being gathered is going far beyond that which we would consider to be traditional marketing. So my question back to you would be, assuming that a properly and up above board and ethical software manufacturer creates adware and discloses to the consumer in the fine print all of the things that they're going to do, do you think that that is an appropriate behavior of a company versus the obvious question of what if they don't tell anyone and just do it secretly?
Right. I think we have to isolate what's the harm.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have software that is harming someone's computer,
mm-hmm.
right, it's basically a type of virus. Well, we need to regulate it on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
If we have software that is surreptitiously extracting data off of a user's hard drive and transmitting it to unknown sources and could be capturing financial data or medical data or even just personal data
mm-hmm.
That people don't want disclosed, and that's opaque to the user, that might need to be regulated on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
But if the software is saying, I think I can help you manage your data flows and get you to the right result from point A to point Z faster than other tools that you might use, I say we want that software. And
mm-hmm.
I'll give you two examples.
Mm-hmm.
You have instant messaging software on your desktop,
mm-hmm.
correct? You get pop-ups from that instant messaging software, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's some user who's trying to reach you
mm-hmm.
And communicate with you. Sometimes those are pop-ups that you want. Sometimes they're pop-ups that you actually would prefer not to have.
Mm-hmm.
You have voluntarily installed that software in order to get pop-ups on your window. Now, you could say, well, that's content, but not advertising. And I'm going to ultimately say that there's no big difference. You have chosen to get software on your desktop that's giving you pop-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a choice that you should have to make. The other example is take a software like what's offered by Southwest Airlines. I don't know if you've ever used
that
software.
Oh, yes.
Ding, where they have some software that people can voluntarily install that will notify them when there's some airfare drop that they might want to take advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
People can choose to install that. That's their choice, correct? And it will be delivering the equivalent of pop-up advertising to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think consumers should have the choice to install it. If they think that's the best way to find out about Southwest Airlines airfares, why wouldn't we want them to have that choice?
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, that's such a no-brainer. And if you think about the movement in the information ecosphere, from giving data that stores on somebody else's server to having the best data stored on your computer, we're seeing more movement towards action on people's desktop as opposed to trying to tell people and have them stored on the other server. So you can tell Amazon some stuff, but they're not going to know very much about you, about your overall life, because they only see what you tell them.
Mm-hmm.
Think about, in contrast, things like Google Desktop, which is out there and actively trying to manage your desktop and at times notifying you when they think there's stuff that's interesting. For example, with their sidebar, is Google desktop spyware or adware? And if so, should we regulate it? In my mind, that is the future. Google Desktop and other client-side software that's monitoring people's behavior and delivering notices to them based on that behavior is the future. And we have to preserve the room for that future to evolve.
I think it's a logical explanation. And if we had more time, I'd go further on it. I'm going to turn quickly to the issue of trademarks rather than fleeing from further discussion of this issue, because I do think you've made your case well. It's the rare opportunity to actually question me on my own show. I'm kidding, of course. Side humor on the radio in the absence of facial expression is always dangerous. I do encourage all guests and anyone else to challenge anything I'm saying on the show, and you can do it by going to hearsayculture.com. Trademark law is an area that you focused on heavily, and it's not an area we've discussed very much on Hearsay Culture. So in the remaining about 7 or 8 minutes that we have, summarize all of trademark law. I'm kidding again. What are a few of the major, maybe let's start with one. What's a major trademark issue on the internet today in your view?
I spend a huge percent of my professional time dealing with the problems associated with search engines or other software using keywords to deliver advertising. This is a topic that we could go on for days and days. This comes up at every professional event I go to. It has been the subject of extensive litigation. It's been the subject of some efforts to do legislation. You can't today talk about internet law without talking about the regulation of keyword advertising.
The analysis of those areas is something which, again, is one of the major challenges. And I guess I want to come back to your focus on search engines themselves. And I know that you were counsel to eOpinions and other companies. Is that what got you into specifically being interested in the search engine issue itself? Because trademarks are generally viewed as the much more commercial oriented of the intellectual property law spheres because of the nature of the very beast and the idea of a trademark. And there I've done. I warned Eric. I said, please don't talk with your hands. And I just did it. I just banged the mic. So this is a particularly loose show. Trademarks as a commercial value and a commercial sphere of intellectual property, as opposed to copyright, which traditionally has more of some of the First Amendment and speech issues. What led you to that focus?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think that trademarks are essential to any free culture as much as copyright. Here to talk at Stanford about the importance of trademarks in order to facilitate a free culture.
Okay.
But I would also take issue with, again, an implicit assumption that you're making in your question, which is that there's some distinction that matters between commercial speech and other types of speech.
Okay.
That's a well-accepted distinction that people make, but I am challenging it. And I think trademarks is a great example about that. And actually, my experience at eOpinions was directly relevant to why I ended up becoming a professor. Mm-hmm. At eOpinions, our model was to create a taxonomy of products and services available in the marketplace. And in order to talk about those products and services, we had to use their trademark descriptions. Mm-hmm. And we let consumers provide their opinions about those goods or services in the marketplace. So people will come and say, this product sucks, or this product was the best thing since sliced bread. And in order for us to allow that information to be disseminated, we had to build a structure that was predicated on other people's trademarks. That was essential not only to provide the skeleton for consumers to flesh out their opinions, but we also then used it to deliver what we consider to be contextually relevant advertising, trademark-associated advertising. And so I was fascinated by the ability of trademark law to inhibit the operation of a site like eOpinions, which was designed to democratize the views about products and services in the marketplace, to help people make better choices in the marketplace. And trademark law had the possibility of actually stripping out all of that information and taking it out of the discourse. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, whether you call that information commercial or non-commercial is immaterial to me. In my mind, it's essential to the operation of the free market. And trademark law has the potential to take to distort the free market by taking that information away from consumers.
The so let me understand your opinion, and it's a shame they only have about 4 minutes left to explore it. So are you suggesting that commercial speech itself should be subject to the same regulation and the same balancing as we, you know, as we give political speech?
Well, I don't understand the distinction. Mm-hmm. And that may go to my point mm-hmm. about people who have a gripe or an opinion mm-hmm. that will shape consumers' choices in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Much like political speech shapes decision makers' choices, whether they're voters or politicians, the information about goods and services in the marketplace shapes decisions in the economic sphere. Mm-hmm. In my mind, they have equal importance in ultimately causing our society to accomplish its goals. So I'm not going to say that we should regulate them equally as much as I'm going to say I can't make a distinction between them. And as a result, any efforts to provide differential treatment, I think, ultimately fail.
You're saying it when you say a distinction, you mean a legal distinction.
A legal distinction. Uh-huh. For that matter, I'm not sure I can make any other distinction. Mm-hmm. But there's no way for us to draft a set of regulations that cleanly carves between commercial speech and other types of speech. So when we see all these regulatory efforts predicated on the assumption that one is more important than the other, they ultimately end up being nonsensical.
Are you concerned that with regard to the internet, you're probably not, but I'll ask it. Are you concerned that with regard to the internet, by conflating the balancing that we do with respect to commercial speech, with the balancing that we might do with respect to political speech, to use that distinction, that the internet will become very much or little more than a paid marketplace?
I guess that it already is. So I don't understand the assumption of that question. But let's try it differently.
Okay.
Consumers need to figure out the authenticity or authority that should be assigned to particular types of content. That cannot always be clear because in some cases it's truly from the heart. In other cases, people are paying to express that opinion. And so consumers may care about that. They may need to do some homework, some digging to figure it out. That's why an intermediary plays such an important role. If you can trust that the intermediary is going to sort through the content to find the genuine opinions and distinguish them from the shills, then you can actually trust the information that you get from that source and make a better decision. So what it's done is it's put pressure on intermediaries to do a better job about making distinctions between trustworthy content and not. And I think consumers ultimately have to decide which sources they trust and don't. That's become, I think, the real battleground on the internet, not the distinctions between commercial speech and political speech.
With regard to Wikipedia, where do you place that in the realm of commercial speech versus non-commercial speech?
Well, that distinction doesn't make any sense to me. Wikipedia is a terrific example. In fact, many people have economic interests when they contribute content to Wikipedia.
But what about the others?
it's either trustworthy or not. Uh-huh. And the commerciality of the speech isn't a good proxy for its trustworthiness. So in other words, you can have vandals out there who have no financial interest and they can distort the system. You can also have marketers out there who are shilling for their own goods or services, and that's not trustworthy. But you can also have legitimate marketers who are paying to spend some time and money in order to improve the database. That might be trustworthy content.
It's a very challenging distinction that you're drawing, and it's one that I think is worthy of further discussion. And certainly, I think, given how lively a discussion this was, and I could have opened up by saying that Eric is one of the guests that I found on today, where we agree on some things, and as anyone who's been listening to the last hour can see, we disagree on others. But I do invite you to come back to discuss these issues. Eric, to the extent that people want to learn more about your work and the work that you're doing in this area, which as anyone listening here can tell, is it really challenges our preconceived notions in many ways of what how we view technology and how we view intellectual property law. And indeed, in particular, Eric's article that we were discussing on comparing the issues to Gose's analysis is something I've actually thought about quite a bit. Where can people turn to learn more about your work?
I have two sources. I have a website at www.ericgoldman.org that has an archive of various things that I published and speeches and slides and so on. And then I also keep up to date with my blog at blog.ericgoldman.org where we keep the discussion going. I have two things to say to you while I still have the mic. I just want to say, first of all, I believe your listeners are already aware of the good news that you have joined the Legal Academy. I am super thrilled for you.
Thank you.
You will be an excellent member of our community, so I'm very glad that has worked out.
Well,
and I also need to say mazel tov to you on your new baby boy. That is terrific news as well. So you've had a great semester, and I'm thrilled for you.
Well, thank you on both fronts. And in return, I will thank you for your generosity in and the writing that you've done in navigating the world of legal academia, something that I certainly turn to. And for anyone who's actually thinking about going into the legal academia world, Eric's blog is a particularly good resource to find postings. So thank you for those thank yous, and thank you for being here. And I do invite you back, notwithstanding my challenging questions and inappropriate attempts to mischaracterize your thoughts. I want to thank you for being here today, and do hope that you'll want to return.
Well, thank you very much.
I want to thank Eric Goldman, Professor Eric Goldman from Santa Clara, for being on. And I do want to thank you for listening today. Hearsay Culture, as many of you know, because you're probably listening to it this way, is podcast, and there's a number of ways to find the show. You can go to hearsayculture.com and actually find not only the schedule, but also find previous shows and the current shows. You can also find the show through the podcast feed on the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And finally, you can subscribe to the CIS webpage in the podcast section of the iTunes service. And that way, not only will you get Hearsay Culture, but you'll get audio from other presentations and talks that are done at Stanford Law School through CIS. So I want to thank you for listening today. This was a very loose conversation, replete with arm gestures towards the mic and pushes back and forth, and a really fun discussion. So I hope you enjoyed it. And I encourage you to stay tuned to KZSU, where you will hear Mike and Baptism of Solitude coming up in a few minutes. And otherwise, I thank you for listening today. Do check out hearsayculture.com and see what's coming up next. And I will look forward to talking to you next week.